You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller. Welcome to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, episode 212. I'm Stephen Seagraves, today joined by Fosma Moon. Hey, Fos.
Hi there.
Seth is not with us today. He's actually at a conference in Boston, and so it's just you and I.
Airline Interiors Expo.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
I think no. It's Passenger Experience Expo, APEX.
Sorry. It's one of these because then when my buddy went and he's like, "Oh, I'm going to Airline Interiors Expo." I'm like, "Okay."
That's in Hamburg, I think.
Oh, you're right. They're all like it's all a blur, even though I've never been to any of them.
It all runs together.
I was going to try to crash, but I couldn't.
You couldn't make it up, so you're not going to go tomorrow?
No.
Oh, darn. So we just had some follow-up from last week. So Seth and I talked last week about the United boarding group changes and how this was coming. It's come and gone now, and the changes are in place.
It's fair to say it's come and gone. It seems like some stations haven't gotten the memo yet.
Okay, so have you experienced the new boarding yet?
I have. It's United. It's consistently inconsistent.
Yeah. I think the 1K, the call for 1Ks is a mess.
I am fully supportive and I love the concept of it. It's going to take some time to read just passenger behavior. Part of the challenge is on one of my flights, they announced 1K and all of Group 1 started walking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like they need to say, no, not Group 1.
Yes.
1K.
Well, I think that's where they might be better suited is a 100,000 flyer.
Yeah.
Instead
of
1K saying calling at the 100,000.
Yep.
And that at least is people don't, because most people are just an autopilot. They want to hear the number and then they go.
Yeah. I feel like the lining up in the boarding lines should be just like, hey, have a seat. We're not boarding yet. When we start boarding, you know, when your group is called, please make your way to the lines then. I think they just need to reiterate that because I'm in line like I normally am. And then there's people just blocking the entire boarding area, so it doesn't matter that they call 1K. Yeah, I still can't get up to the front. It doesn't matter.
But you shouldn't have to be in the line. You should be able to go in the bypass lane, like the GSs and stuff.
But what's the bypass lane? Like now that they only have two lines, it's like one and two. Where's the bypass?
More and more gates at the airports that they've been. I saw it in Houston. I know this is the case in Newark. The next to the podium is not a line. The line goes around the corner.
So, are you saying, like, up next to the podium is where you go?
Yeah, just walk up right to the podium.
Oh, okay.
Basically, when you're looking at the boarding door, the lines are generally snaking to the left or the right from the door. They're not coming out from the door. You just walk straight to the door.
Gotcha. Okay. I'll try it. I'm flying on Monday.
Like you own the place.
I'm interested to see how it goes at some of these outstations. Like I'm, you know, flying from Portland on Monday. So we'll see how it goes.
So. Portland.
What was that?
Portland isn't a regional station yet?
Almost. It's getting there.
Air Wisconsin.
Oh, God. I don't even want to talk about that. So in some news, this is kind of an older story, but there was an Air India 777-300 that had some serious issues coming into JFK. And this was, I'm trying to think, this was during there was a big thing of weather in New York. And so about 2 weeks
very,
ago. Yeah.
Very recent.
So what happened was they were coming in, everything seemed normal, and as they were making the approach, they asked to go, you know, to be taken out of sequence to work out some issues, and they weren't able to establish themselves on the localizer. So every time the plane navigation system would try to lock onto the localizer, the thing that basically hones in and helps you land, gives you a kind of a vertical and horizontal navigation piece, so in low visibility you can tell where the runway is, it wouldn't lock on to that piece of equipment.
And it should be noted, ceilings were like 600, 700 feet this day.
And they were dropping down to like 200 in some places. So there are minimums for large jets. There are minimums at airports for what planes are rated for what type of landing. So these are called CAT landings. And I'm not going to go into the specifics around it, but they basically had to have this piece of equipment functioning to make the approach into JFK. Come to find out, after they're trying to work all this out, they're trying to find, you can hear video or hear audio of this. They're trying to ask air traffic control for an alternate airport. Well, all of New York City is socked in at this point. All of upstate New York is socked in at this point. Their options then become Dulles and Boston. And these pilots decide, well, we'll just try for Newark because things are a little better there.
Well, and they're low on fuel.
Yeah, by this time, they are low on fuel. They're down to about 7,500 pounds of fuel, or 7,500 kilos, excuse me, of fuel, which comes out to about 15,000 pounds. So they weren't in like a dire situation. But when they came back on with ATC, who was asking what the actual problem was, they did not have either side of the cockpit. So there's redundancy. Neither side had the localizer working. Neither side had radio altimeters working. And all they had was the primary altimeter and the primary localizer, which was having trouble connecting. So they were basically flying in the dark, essentially, as far as radio communications, or not radio but navigation communications are concerned. But they made a fine landing at Newark, which is what they're trained to do. It's just weird to me when you listen to the audio how much time passes by before a decision is actually made on where they should go.
Well, so the first question is, how much of that stuff was inoperable when they left New Delhi?
I don't think any of that stuff can be, honestly. I don't think it's MEL equipment. It's not. I think it's equipment that you have to have.
Again, this is Air India.
Touche.
This is the same airline that decided to strip a brand new 787 for parts.
Well said.
So, my question stands.
How much this was broken?
Yeah, how much of this was broken, right? Because it's uncommon for this many. Like, we've never had a failure like this that I've ever heard of, where this many things go wrong. So my inclination is to say some of this stuff was already inoperable before it left. Now, should they have left? No. The other thing is, like, there's some assumptions being made, right? You're not really going to use a localizer until you go to approach. So you might not even know it's broken.
Well, here's the other things. Here's something else. So I've left this part out. They did not have TCAS, which is the traffic collision and avoidance system. They didn't have that. That failed. They did not have Autoland, which is it's basically a glide slope helper and basically pulls controls speed and the glide slope of the plane. They didn't have wind shear systems, and they had no auto speed brakes and no auxiliary power unit.
So are they sure they did? Are they sure they didn't take the spare plane they were stripping parts from?
I mean, they were essentially flying with very few things working in the cockpit.
But this is what's concerning to me, right? This is a 14-15 hour flight. Why not go back at the time that you take off when you recognize some of the stuff isn't working?
Maybe we don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at. Let me look and see if AV Herald. I'll play producer has anything on this, because I want to know when they actually realized that these things weren't working.
I mean, why would you want to go on a 14 and a half, 15 hour flight with no TCAS?
I don't think you could cross the Atlantic without TCAS. I think you would have to have it.
Again, only if you tell people.
Let's see here. I'm looking real quick online to see if I see anything. Let's see. There it is. It just calls it an incident, I believe. So it's nothing severe. It doesn't say when they found it. Huh. Wow.
I mean,
it doesn't say.
Yeah, at some point when the NTSB does their investigation, we'll find out.
Yeah.
But I mean, until then, Air India has basically said no comment, so I don't think they're going to tell us anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a very, very weird situation. And then, sure enough, the plane flew back the next day.
Which is even more concerning.
Unless, like, a fuse was blown. Like, it was just, like, one fuse.
But how do you not check that? Right, I mean, it's completely possible that some of the avionics blew and they just replaced them. But wouldn't you want to test the plane some more to see why they all died?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that there's like some cases where you have to actually, if you lose power, you have to do a transfer bus to isolate where the problem is.
Yep.
And I'm assuming that they tried that and found that neither system was operable. But it's weird to me that it would everything like all that stuff would fail together because those systems do operate independently of each other.
They will. And I mean, like I said, we're making the assumption in that case that everything was working when they left New Delhi. And quite candidly, if I was a betting man, I would say they were not.
Oh, man. I'm not going to take that bet because for some reason I think you're right. Anyway, let's talk about American Airlines and some things going on in Congress. So as of today, this news is, I mean, it's kind of old. We're recording this on a Tuesday. But recently, Congress was introducing a bill that was going to, was going to limit how much airlines could change for or charge for change fees. This is now dead, right? Or that part of the bill is dead.
It is dead. That part of the bill is dead because it was part of the FAA reauthorization bill. So, you know, clearly the FAA has been funded again. Mm-hmm. So that is no longer an issue. But they did end up pulling it out because, well, the airline lobby. Why else? There's no other reason. You know, let's be real, right? So, it was interesting because Parker, of course, you know, being the anti-consumer CEO he is, got front and center saying, well, if they do that, we'll just make, you know, not leave any value on non-refundable tickets.
Yeah. To where, you know, even if you wanted to change and pay a fee, you couldn't do that because they've gotten rid of the ability to do that.
Yes, because they're claiming, well, you know, we count on that seat being full and, you know, talking about airline calculus, for lack of a better term, yet they never talk about the fact that they oversell these seats as well.
Yeah, I was kind of mixed on this whole topic. So, I mean, he's basically saying we're not going to charge or we're not just have – if you guys do this, Congress passes this, we just won't allow ticket changes at all.
Which, I mean, when you look at the change fees, right, it was like within 20 years – change fees were $50.
Yeah.
Right. And in a very short order of time, they've gone from 50 to 75 to 100 to 150 to 200.
Yep.
And there's clearly not going down. And I think the airlines are getting a little too egregious on the fees.
Yep.
That's what, like, one of the reasons why I love Alaska, right? As an elite, there are no change fees. And so when I, like, if I'm buying a ticket on United, I pretty much have to make sure that I'm going to go before I commit to a ticket. On Alaska, I'm always willing to take the bet. So they get the money, they hold on to the money. You know, I'll cancel the reservation days out generally if I don't need it. But I think Alaska is brilliant in that approach.
Like you get the residual value, you don't pay a change fee.
Right.
So they're going to get their money.
They already have your money.
Well, they're going to get the money, but what I mean is, like, they may actually make more money because now they can sell that seat that you didn't take.
Right, and most likely whatever seat I buy next is going to cost more.
Yeah, so you're just able to apply that value. Yeah, I mean, I think it keeps money in play. It encourages people to, you know, make changes when needed and not feel obligated. But then by keeping the money in the airline, you know, you say, hey, you can make a change, but you might have to pay more for whatever flight you do take.
I think the biggest thing that the airlines tend to forget is the goodwill that it generates.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Like, absolutely.
I have very few bad things to ever say about Alaska. I can't even say that about, you know, I can pretty much pick any other airline and say all sorts of bad things, but Alaska is generally pretty decent and I find them to be easy to work with.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And it's easy to find, you know, the residual value that you have left on these tickets, et cetera. If you need to, you call in, give them the thing, give them your confirmation number or give them the e-ticket number and they'll tell you, oh, you know, it's $200 left on this ticket. How would you like to use it?
And,
you know, it's not a big deal. I think that does create some goodwill and return customers. People are like, oh, that was so easy. Like, I didn't even have to really work to get my ticket to be usable.
And I think it's ridiculous that the airlines, you know, particularly their high-end frequent flyers, that they nail them so often with these fees because you know they're going to come back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is, like, that's why they do nail them with the fee, though, wouldn't you say? It's like, maybe, they're loyal.
Well, they're loyal, but you're also disenfranchising them, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, why would you want to take the person who gives you 15, 20 grand a year and disenfranchise them over $200?
True. That's a good point. Yeah, I think it's we'll have to see where this goes because I mean, it's for now it's dead in Congress. This proposal to get rid of fees, but I don't think I don't think this is the end of that discussion. I think we'll eventually see something else come out of Congress around this.
Yeah, I mean, they did limit seat size, but I don't think that's going to make much of a difference in the current day and age.
Yeah, they'll just change the definition of an inch.
Yeah, exactly. We'll go to centimeters. It's still 30.
Oh, man. Heaven help us. So Emirates and Etihad have talked about a merger. What is the story here?
I mean, they're both owned by the parts of the UAE royalty. And so Etihad is currently clearly struggling financially because, you know, they made some bad bets on Alitalia and Air Berlin. who knew that would have gone south? But on the contrary, Emirates has maintained a solid business, even through a downturn and, you know, the Gulf embargo that we had last year. Or not embargo, but the restrictions around Gulf flights. And then now there's talk to merge the two because, you know, Etihad is struggling and who knows if they'll really be able to survive long term. Will it happen? Who knows? Someone's pride clearly has to, you know, come down off the line.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're owned by different parts of the royal family, I think. I'm not exactly sure of the ownership, but it's two different sects, I know that.
Hmm. And they're both considered like the official carrier, right, of the UAE, or is it Etihad's the official carrier?
I don't know if either one is the official carrier of the UAE.
Mm.
They're associated by city because Etihad is based in Abu Dhabi and Emirates is based in Dubai. And the question does come up that if they do merge, how do you make two hubs 70, 80 miles apart work?
Well, I don't know. It might actually work out for people who are, you know, build a Hyperloop.
Okay, but
I talked about that in the last show. We talked about like high speed train travel between two airports.
Well, and then the question, and I think Seth talked about that, which is an interesting concept. But then the other thing I would bring up is a lot of this traffic is transit traffic.
Yeah.
Does it really matter
which airport they use? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, if you're just transiting, if you're not stopping in Dubai or starting in Dubai or vice versa with Abu Dhabi, does it matter which airport you come into? Probably not. I mean, you could use one of the airports as a connection airport if needed.
Well, you could do that, or you can also stagger, like, you know, say as an example, Pune. You know, you've alternate Monday, Wednesday, Friday flights, so Pune go from Dubai, the other days it goes from Abu Dhabi or vice versa.
Mm.
You could do some interesting things.
Yeah.
But it also gives you the ability to control some of your flow for transit traffic, because there's clearly destinations which are, I'd be willing to bet, New York to India is a very high transit population. You could easily route those through a secondary hub.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good point. I just don't know if I see it happening as far as the two merging. I think there's too much at stake for either carrier. And there's a lot of pride sitting on both carriers. If anything, I think Emirates comes out as the dominant carrier regardless.
Oh yeah. I mean, they're like three or four times the size, right?
Yeah. But I think that they come out the dominant carrier, which reading on the history of Etihad, I think that might be a problem. I don't know. I don't see it.
Well, I think Etihad's days are numbered if they don't.
Mm.
I think that's the real driver. Emirates has very little incentive to do anything. I think this would be driven much more from the Etihad side because they're struggling. You know, they lost billions of dollars propping up failing airlines.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and what do you think about like ticket prices? I see, you know, I mean, here you have one, it's one of the Gulf carriers, them and Qatar. And so Emirates, Qatar, and Etihad are the three main Gulf carriers.
Mm-hmm.
If you take that down to two, do you see an increase in prices?
Oh, I doubt it.
You think so?
I don't think Etihad impacts the price that much.
Even with their lift out of, you know, United States to, you know, India and things like that, out of, you know, but Dulles and JFK.
They've got what, one flight? They're dropping Dallas if they haven't already. They're dropping San Francisco if they haven't already. So they're down to LA, Dulles, JFK, Chicago?
Chicago, yeah.
Right? Compared to Emirates is what, 14, 15 destinations.
Yeah.
Right. And Emirates is dropping 380s into how many of those?
Yeah. True. I mean, I think the one key factor there is that Abu Dhabi has the U.S. preclearance. So, you know, that could be an impactful piece where, you know, let's say put flights out of the U.S. and into the U.S. out of Abu Dhabi and into Europe, into, you know, Dubai or something like that.
Well, and that's possible. But then you because it's not a lot of O&D traffic, you have to look at the flow aspect as well. So you're going to be flying people from Pune to Europe and the U.S. Now are you going to have overlapping flights?
Yeah, good point.
Right. Or you could do like what BA did with the London City flight, right? The morning flight's a preclearance and the evening is not.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Good point. What else do we have here? Let me see. Story-wise. Oh, so you mentioned that Delta is currently undergoing a system outage. And this is Tuesday, September 25th, that we're recording this. And is that still ongoing, as far as you know?
As far as I know. It's like making the rounds in the news outlets right now, but they've been having they've been having issues for a few hours now. People can't log in. Flights are all grounded.
Really?
Yep. And there's a lovely storm that just moved out of New York City, so the flights all here have been whacked all day.
Wow. Wow. That's not good.
Not a good day to be in Atlanta.
No.
You know, but this – I'm going to go on a slight tangent here. This brings up the question of technology and travel companies.
Mm-hmm.
Why do travel companies suck so much on technology?
I mean, my United app keeps logging me out after the latest iOS update.
When it is a key part of their business at this point, right? Like, and the Starwood Marriott merger, great example of how to really take things, you know, to a whole new level of suck.
Yeah.
There's no reason it should have been as bad as it was. They weren't moving to a whole new platform as they had initially tried to position before the merger. It's evident that they just took all the Starwood accounts and moved into the Marriott platform. They probably had to add some capacity, but it wasn't a whole new platform. There's no reason it should have taken them 4 weeks to do that.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And so I've been, you know, because you and I work in this industry, so we know this pretty well. And I think the biggest problem is that there's no expertise at these companies on these systems they use.
Mm.
Right? These things are not complicated. This is like Starwood Marriott merger is just merging data sets. It shouldn't be that complicated. But it's, you know, from the fact that they couldn't track the elite nights properly, just means they didn't understand what they were working with ahead of time. Had they done it, they would have been able to account the, oh, these two are overlapping and they shouldn't be counted.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, it's just like, and it's just plain stupidity. Like these outages we see on the airlines, it's often something stupid like a bad network connection or lack of redundancy in these systems.
Yeah, I mean, you make great points. I think, you know, as an IT organization, I mean, these are travel companies. They are delivering people safely to places and yet cannot always keep their IT infrastructure up. And this isn't the first outage for Delta in the last, what, year?
This is like the third in like the last 18 months or fourth.
Yeah. So, you know, this is one of those things where you really start to irritate and lose customers when you cannot keep your systems up and running. And I think that goes for every airline out there. If they can't keep things up and running, they're going to lose people.
Yeah.
And it's just not a good way to do business. And it's simple things. It's like you said, you know, power supplies at a, you know, data center.
Yeah.
You know, it's things like the redundancy, you know, not having redundancy. If we expect planes to be redundant, we should expect the technology that supports the staff and the employees to be redundant as well to make things run smoothly.
Absolutely. And I think part of the problem, you know, is that all these institutions have outsourced so much of their business to people who don't know their business.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. And so there's, and, you know, I've seen enough outsourcing deals go bad, but there's a fundamental difference between someone who has a vested interest in the survival of a company and someone who is just another customer.
Mm.
So take like a frontline, you know, someone who, and you see this in every paradigm, but you see someone who has equity in the company, be it pride, be it actual stock, be it whatever, who actually works for the company takes a much higher personal responsibility for success.
Yeah.
Versus a vendor that you just outsource it to.
Yeah.
And in all these situations, a lot of the problems that we hear about is all because of it's outsourced to a third party and they don't understand how this stuff works.
Yep. Yep. True.
How's that for off topic tangent?
Well, no, but I think it's very true. And I think, you know, there are so many aspects, and this is true for business as well. There's so many aspects to running a good business. It's how do you treat your employees? How do your employees treat the customers? How does your IT system integrate with those employees to make sure that their experience and the experience that the customers is having is enjoyable and not annoying? That's the main thing, not annoying. And I think a lot of lip service is paid to these things, but not a lot of action is taken to make these things work together.
No. I think there's just not enough priority given to this.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is leadership doesn't understand some of the challenges.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how critical these things are. Often you'll hear customer or companies say, well, you know, we outsource our janitorial, so it's no different. And the reality is, if your janitors don't show up to work for a day, your business doesn't stop.
Yep. 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 It's true. And I think too, when you outsource these things to people who don't understand how the business works, you irritate the people that are working for you because they feel like they're fighting a battle.
I'm going to pick on American for a moment. You know, it's only in the last year that we have the ability to book a flight in the app now.
Yeah.
Right. And this is like basic functionality. Like your job is to sell tickets. And the reason these things take so long is because, and this is where I will give United credit, they're very nimble on their digital real estate because they own the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So every time they need to make a change, they just need to huddle up inside, figure out what they need to do, and go do it. Whereas American or Delta, because they're relying on either Sabre or WorldSpan, every time something needs to happen, they need to go to the vendor. The vendor needs to go carve out a quote and a change order. It's a long, arduous process, which is why nothing ever happens quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, that's this falls back on the airlines for not, you know, and for lacking a vision, because if they actually had a vision, they'd be like, we need to do these things and prioritize them.
Mm-hmm.
But a vendor is never going to just jump. I mean, you remember back in the old days of pre-merger United where, you know, everything sucked and they'd never fix anything. Yeah. But the moment somebody published a Canadian fuel dump, 4 hours later, it was fixed.
Yeah.
Right, you would have never seen that kind of breakneck speeds from United unless there was a big deal behind it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's true. It's true. It's where they care. It's where they think, you know, they're making money or losing money. That they'll quickly apply patches and resources to fix. But the truth is that the day to day stuff is what matters.
The day to day stuff is what matters because that's the day to day experience. And you know, it's like I talk to folks who fly other airlines who, you know, get on a United flight and get on the app. Like, you guys can see all this stuff? Oh, yeah. Like, we've been able to see this stuff for 10 years.
Yeah.
This is not new.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. It's true. Oh, man. Technology. Technology.
The more it stays the same.
Yeah. So Seth shared a story. There is a gentleman in New Zealand who he lives in South Auckland, who has an airplane in his backyard. He's a plane lover and brought this plane into the backyard and has just put it kind of up on the fence in the backyard and is just enjoying it. Had a crane deliver it and everything. It's great. I actually can't tell what kind of plane it is in the pictures, but here. Oh, it is. It's an Embraer Bandeirante. Portuguese for pioneer. And it was flown actually by Eagle Air, Air New Zealand Link from 1988 until 2001. And so he put it in his backyard. The ultimate air geek, I think.
That's hysterical.
Sure. Do you want a plane?
I want something bigger, not a little puddle jumper.
Well, there's a guy here in Oregon that has a 727 that's in his backyard down south of here. And he just had this like giant party at it, which I find odd because the plane doesn't have like a true bathroom or kitchen or anything. But this guy had a party in it and it went like all night long.
Did you go?
No, I'm not. I don't drop enough acid for that scene.
I was gonna say, are you sure it wasn't just a rave?
It looked like, based on the pictures, it looked like a rave. We'll put them in the show notes. It definitely looked like one. So
I mean, this story is just on the heels of where, you know, they took a 747 to Burning Man, promised they'd take it, clean it out, and then they left it there.
It's like, what are you gonna do? Like, oh well, we'll just tow truck it out, I guess.
I want to know how they got it there.
Yeah, I mean, do you want a 747?
I don't have any place to put it, but yes.
I mean, we can find somewhere.
I mean, I'm bummed the Turkish government got the 748.
You know what's hilarious is they didn't even fly that to UN week. Ugh, they brought the 346 and some other support planes.
Who knows?
I don't know.
They let Turks into the country?
Oh, God. Yes, they did. They were Erdogan was definitely here.
Okay.
Any other stories you want to talk about? It's a short show today, but I think that's okay.
United at Amsterdam sucks.
Oh, yeah. You wanted to tell us about your experience. Go for this. I think this was a great way to spend the last 10 minutes of the show.
Oh, you're going to break out some popcorn now?
I am. I'm getting it out right now.
So last week, I was due to fly Amsterdam to Houston and then Houston to San Francisco. And I really need to be in San Francisco. And the day before, the flight had taken a 2.5-3 hour mechanical delay. Unclear why, but it did. So, you know, I got down to the gate right just before boarding time, and boarding time comes and there's no movement. And then 10, 15 minutes later, they finally announced that the flight's going to take a delay because it has a leak, and that's all they would tell us. And of course, they start with a creeping delay. Which is, you know, and I get the stuff happens. That's all fine. So I go up to the desk and I said, well, and they also were kind enough to announce that the crew times out in 3 hours. So, you know, my gut says if they're talking about crew timeout as they announced the first delay, this is not going to be good. So I'm like, okay. So I go up to the desk. I'm like, you know, I'm going to San Francisco. I just need to know what my options are. And they look at me and go, we're not rebooking anyone. We are going to wait till the flight leaves, and then we'll work with our colleagues in Houston to rebook you, which, in, you know, honestly says, we'll let Houston deal with it and just ignore this.
Yeah.
So I said, well, will you post the delay? We'll post it eventually. I'm like, well, until you can post it, I can't call the 1K desk to get rebooked. We'll post it. When? Well, we don't know. Okay, 5-10 minutes? Maybe. I'm like, this is ridiculous. So I eventually just, like, walk away. I call the 1K desk. Very nice woman says, you know, there's nothing on. She's like, there's a seat on the Chicago flight if you can make it to that. I'm literally walking by the Chicago gate. I'm like, done. So she puts me out and she can't reissue the ticket. I go up to the counter. I'm waiting. There's a couple in front of me who clearly also moved on to this flight from the Houston flight. Three agents, four agents at the desk. Only one's helping the customers. Behind me is another gentleman who got rebooked and a non-rev employee who's trying to get a jump seat. As we're standing there, the other three agents are ignoring us. The one agent just takes her sweet old time with this one couple and then proceeds. While we're waiting there, one of the agents from the Houston flight comes over to do something and then sees me and this other guy and says, you guys need to go back to the Houston gate. And we're like, no, we're already rebooked on this flight. There's some exchange in Dutch, unclear what happened. But from that point forward, we were ignored the rest of the time until they closed out the flight.
Jeez. Why is it such a problem? That would blow. Oh man, I'd be furious.
And I'm on the 1K agent is still on the phone, and the lead at the gate is telling me, "Oh, there's no seat for you in business." I'm like, I have the 1K desk on the phone. She has it put in my reservation. There's no seat up there. And so the 1K and I tell the 1K agent, she releases the seat. She goes, it went back in. She's like, I can grab it again. And I tell her, she goes, and the gate agent's like, it's not there. I later found out what happened from what I can extrapolate is that she upgraded some non-revs and she didn't want to move them, which I'm just appalled that you would bump a paying customer.
Yeah.
For a non-rev.
Yeah.
So I'm currently in, and I've also demanded EU comp from United because I got to San Francisco almost 4 hours late. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, I'm learning EU comp is not just the flight posted a delay and we'll pay it out. Because I had the same thing with BA a couple months ago. There's a whole legal process it has to go through and legal has to bless the payouts.
Hmm.
So the
customer... isn't your first experience with United and the EU rules, right?
No, this is my first one with United. My last one was BA.
Oh, I thought I remember someone else having a United story and saying it sucked trying to get it all sorted out.
You know, the customer care agent's been pretty on it. She, you know, she when I first opened the request, they responded very quickly. She forgot to put her name in Friday. She called me and left me a message going, I just want you to know I haven't forgotten about you. I'm still waiting on, you know, some of our internal folks to figure out how we're going to handle this. I'm out Monday and Tuesday, but I'll connect with you on Wednesday. I mean, they couldn't handle it any better. So, I mean, I'm definitely... They're handling it properly, but it's just interesting how complicated EU comp is.
Yeah, yeah. Not a simple, submit it and get your comp.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting stuff, man. I mean, I had a... Last week, I had a experience where the IFE on my plane, or the Wi-Fi, excuse me, wasn't working, and they told everyone beforehand. And then on the flight, they said, oh, by the way, the Wi-Fi is working. And then 10 minutes later, no, we're sorry, we were wrong. It was just a bizarre experience of miscommunication. So, but whatever.
You know. Keep you on your toes.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, I think that's a show. Good luck with the EU comp. And hopefully you don't have to deal with those agents in Amsterdam again.
Oh, I'm about to send in my commentary to United. I decided I'd sit on it a little bit and reread it and polish it before I sent off my scathing.
You didn't want to send just like a rage letter?
I almost did. I decided to temper myself.
Good for you. Good for you. All right. Well, our listeners can find us on Twitter at DotsLines, moredotsmorelines.com. Leave us a comment. Check us out on Patreon. Subscribe there. You get the episodes a little early. And yeah, thanks for listening and happy travels. Bye-bye.
See ya.